The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Supplement to your bibliography in this section, there's a book. this is just a little thing that may help you get it all together. There's a book written by a fellow named Jim Halsey called For Such a Time as This. I think I have it listed under Van Til on your bibliography because I saw it in a book list and it was under Van Til there. And I thought, well, you know, Van Til's always writing books. He must be having another book coming out. So I put it out as authored by Van Til. Turns out that it's not written by Van Til. It's rather about Van Til, and it's called For Such a Time as This. It's a popular summary of Van Til's teachings, and it kind of follows, in a way, the outline that we've used in this course, although there's been no consultation between Halsey and me. He starts off by talking about Van Til's theological assumptions, and then he talks about Van Til's epistemology, his theory of knowledge, and then he talks about some of Van Til's criticisms of other philosophers. And a lot of this, he doesn't say anything new, really. He doesn't won't help you to resolve any of the problems that are come up in Van Til's writings, but he does give you a kind of summary of Van Til's thinking on a lot of matters that a lot of people find a need for that. It is a little organized, a little bit more logically than some of Van Til's own writings are, and so you can, I think, learn from it. Okay, Christianity and the Great Debates. Now, in part two of this course, The Doctrine of the Knowledge of God, I tried to describe to you a biblical approach to apologetics. In part three, we will be doing apologetics, addressing some of the crucial debates of human history, focusing particularly on the disciplines of philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Now, we wouldn't have to choose those disciplines. We could have chosen other disciplines. We could profitably have discussed literature, music, art, politics, economics, the history of science, mathematics, and so on. We could have discussed a great many different areas of human thought. However, it's been traditional in the apologetics course to focus on philosophy and theology. Of course, you have to focus on something. If you try to cover the whole range of human thinking, you're going to be incredibly superficial. Another reason for focusing on these particular disciplines is that most apologists are philosophically trained. That's Van Til's training, and it's also my training. There are a few, of course, such as Gary North and Douglas Vickers, who are trained in economics, and people like Ruzus Rushdoony, who are very interested in political theory. But most of us know more about philosophy than we know about those things. And perhaps it's just as well. I think it's easier to show the issues, the fundamental issues that divide Christians from non-Christians in the field of philosophy than in other fields. It is, after all, the job of the philosopher to give arguments for his convictions and even his basic convictions about the world. And when you get into those arguments, that's where you see the in the most concise way, the differences between Christian approaches and non-Christian approaches. A knowledge of philosophy also, I think, can help you to analyze issues in other fields. I think, in other words, that philosophy is perhaps the most fertile of those disciplines in giving you tools to analyze other disciplines. If you have a good grasp of the history of philosophy, you probably already have most of the tools needed for analyzing art and literature and the politics and economics, whereas I think it does not as easily work the other way. So this is why a number of these reasons, and perhaps others too, these are reasons why we're focusing on philosophy and also to some extent on theology in this part of the course. Now I'm going to have to ask your indulgence here. This part of the course is even in cruder form than parts 1 and 2. I had hoped to have this material in much better shape than it is. And I'm not exactly apologizing to you because I haven't been goofing off. I've been trying to do my job here, but I don't know exactly where in my schedule I could have carved out a few hours to put this in better shape. I suppose I should have said no to somebody along the line, but I still haven't the slightest idea where. So I guess here we go, for better or worse, and ask questions, you know, and so on. Well, okay, this lecture outline, I don't know, I just threw that together back in August sometime, and I probably won't even follow it most of the time, but there it is. It gives you some names that maybe you haven't heard of before and maybe you'll never hear of again, and you may find some use for it other than wrapping fish or whatever. Okay, now, first, a few introductory remarks on the nature of philosophy. The most important thing to remember about philosophy, I think, is that philosophy is a religious quest. It asks questions of a religious character. The question, why is there something rather than nothing? The question of creation, in other words. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why are things the way they are? The question of providence. How is knowledge possible? What is knowledge? How do we go about knowing? The epistemological question. And of course, we saw in part 2 of the course how that epistemological question is very much a religious question, how it's an ethical question as well. But philosophy is not only implicitly ethical, it's explicitly ethical too. Philosophers ask the question, how ought I to live? As we've seen over and over again, the only way that can be answered really is by a word from God, by God's revelation, God's commandment. So that all of the questions that philosophy is historically and typically preoccupied with are religious questions, or questions at least that have religious roots. Philosophy, historically, has tried to push those questions to their limit, to give final and ultimate answers to them, or else to show that no answer is possible. Now, here you have two different kinds of philosophers, basically. You might call them optimists and pessimists. You might call them rationalists and irrationalists. The optimists, the rationalists, try to give answers to these basic questions that trouble human beings. The pessimists, the irrationalists, try to show that no answer is really possible to those questions, and that when we ask such questions, we're simply worrying ourselves over matters that can't be resolved. We're engaging in pointless worry. Now, the Christian will answer those basic questions on the basis of revelation. He may indeed develop what might be called a Christian philosophy, by which he can think through the applications of the word, and also by which he can carry on a humble, obedient speculation on aspects of those questions that are not resolved by Scripture. Now remember, when I defined a philosophy for you earlier in the course, when I talked about Christian philosophy, I wasn't able to draw a very sharp distinction between philosophy and theology. About all I could say on that in that respect was that the theologian tries to achieve a thus saith the Lord authority in the statements that he makes. He may not always achieve it, but that's his goal. He tries to reach that point. Whereas the philosopher although if he's a Christian, he has to make use of authoritative statements. Nevertheless, it's not his goal to achieve those authoritative statements. His goal as a philosopher is to present positions well-grounded in his own wisdom and so on, which do not contradict the Word. And on that kind of basis, he can utter things, he can teach things that Scripture does not teach, but which he thinks are grounded in his own observations and thinking, and which are compatible with a biblical position. Now, so there may be a kind of Christian philosophy, but that Christian philosophy will be a very humble business. It will be an enterprise which is self-consciously subordinate to the Scriptures. Now, the non-Christian, of course, will not be satisfied with such a humble role for philosophy. The non-Christian will use philosophy as a replacement for revelation. He will be rejecting the Word of God, as Eve did in the Garden of Eden. You might even point to Eve as the first philosopher who made her own judgments about ultimate questions, as she Van Til talks about her making a commitment on ontology. Well, the term ontology probably would not have occurred to Eve in the Garden of Eden, but essentially that's what she was doing. So the philosopher then will reject God's Word as Eve did in the Garden of Eden. He will try to find his own answers to those religious questions, either to find the answers or to claim that there are no answers. He'll try to find answers by means of reason, by means of sensation, imagination, feeling, intuition, all of those faculties that we talked about the other day, or by some combination of those. Historically, the earliest philosophies and many of the later ones originated in skepticism about traditional religion. The Greek philosophies originated in Greek religion. That's discussed somewhat by Herman Duyverd in his book In the Twilight of Western Thought. And although I disagree with a great many things in that book, I think that he also gives you some real insight into the origins of Greek philosophy particularly, and I'd urge you to look that over sometime when you get the chance. He argues that the earliest philosophies originated in kind of a reaction to the popular religions, and the first philosophies can be seen as sophisticated, rationalized, cleaned up versions of the popular religious notions. But okay, so we've seen philosophy as a kind of secularized religion. Philosophy as a kind of replacement for religion. Philosophy is an attempt to rationalize and clean up one's religious concepts. And philosophy, therefore, as a form of religion, as a kind of, done in a non-Christian way, as an apostate religion, as a non-Christian religion. But now when you try to substitute your own philosophical skill for, or when you try to substitute the philosophical skills of mankind for God's revelation, you wind up in a number of very serious problems. On the one hand, you want to say, you want to believe the truth really exists. The truth is available to the mind. In fact, you want to argue that truth is so available that nothing can be unknowable. Nothing can be unknowable. After all, if anything is unknowable, how do you know that it's unknowable? If elephants are unknowable, how do you know that there are such things as elephants? And how do you know that those elephants are unknowable? Or elements, take your choice. The idea of something unknowable seems to be contradictory. If you have something that's unknowable, how can you even form an idea of it? So that suggests, that kind of reasoning suggests that anything that we can speak of, anything that we can think of, is knowable. Now, there may be things that we can't think of, but if there are, we had just better be silent about them, right? we better not talk about them. We better not, if there's something unknowable, you can't call it an elephant because you don't know what its name is. If there's something unknowable, you can't even call it a thing. You don't even know that it is a thing. In fact, you better not even say it's unknowable because you don't know it's unknowable. So if there's something unknowable, you better not talk about it at all. And what that means is that for all practical purposes, you assume that everything is knowable. You can't even say meaningfully that something is unknowable. So you just drop that from your vocabulary. Having dropped it from your vocabulary, then you adopt this principle, this rationalistic principle, that nothing is unknowable, that everything is accessible to the human mind. This we may call the principle of rationalism. On the other hand, this kind of reasoning just doesn't really seem to jibe with reality, does it? Because it seems from experience that the mind is not omniscient. It seems from experience that the mind is not omnipotent. The mind does make mistakes. The mind does have its limits. And so it seems terribly arrogant to say that all things are knowable. Obviously, our senses deceive us. Obviously, our thoughts deceive us. Even our logic deceives us in the way that we use it. In this whole big universe, do we want to say really seriously that everything is knowable? Why, the universe overwhelms us. And how can we, when we get into this mood, when we're looking up at the stars and we're overwhelmed by the complexity of the creation and the complexity of the issues that we're trying to think through and rationalize, how dare we claim that everything is knowable, that everything is understandable, that everything is accessible to the mind? And so we're forced into another kind of thinking, which might be called the principle of irrationalism, that there is a limit, that there is a difficulty, that thinking does not always reach its object. And so we vacillate. Particularly the unbeliever who's thinking without revelation, he's kind of a manic depressive. He vacillates from this incorrigible optimism that everything is knowable and that it's even meaningless to talk about anything unknowable. On the other hand, he claims that he sees the limits of his own mind. He can't ignore that. It presses in upon him on every side. And so he's forced then into a kind of skepticism, into a kind of irrationalism. Let me further expound the irrationalist alternative in the following way. If you insist on applying your rational categories to all of reality, exhaustively to all reality, despite the limits of your mind, what are you doing? Aren't you just projecting your own ideas onto reality? Aren't you just taking your theories and trying to force reality into the shape of your own theories? If I assume that my logic applies everywhere when it doesn't, of course, I can, by sheer force of will, I can force all reality into that scheme. But when I do that, what do I know? It turns out that all I've got is a pale reflection of my scheme. I've ruled out everything that doesn't fit. And just like old Procrustes, you know, the Greek fellow who had a bed in his house, and if somebody was too long, he'd cut off the feet. And if somebody was too short, he'd stretch out the person so that he'd fit in the bed. Well, you kill an awful lot of people that way. And when you try to forge reality so that it fits your own system, you're going to get left out of an awful lot, and you're going to find out that all you know in the final analysis is your own system. All you know is what you think. Let's say you assume that all swans are white and you run into a black swan somewhere. What are you going to do with that black swan? Well, if you insist, my theory has got to cover all of reality. My theory is exhaustive. My theory is universal. There can be no exceptions to it. Well, you say there must be something wrong with my perceptions here. We have to rule out that black swan. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're just going to ignore it. all of reality has to conform to the principle that all swans are white. Well, when you do that, you simply rule out all the black swans. You rule out everything that doesn't conform to your theory, and you find out that all you know is your own thoughts. All you know is what you think. All of reality just becomes a pale reflection of you, so that there's nothing to be known. The object of knowledge disappears, and all that remains is the subject. The object of knowledge disappears. All that remains is the subject. And so, here we have the pole of irrationalism. In irrationalism, we reach the frustration of rationalism. Down here, we assume that nothing is unknowable. And we push that assumption, and we push that assumption despite the limits that we know exist. And when we press that assumption and press it, we find that we really don't know anything at all. We find that we know only ourselves. We find that we know only our theories, that our theories don't come in touch with reality, that our rationalizations don't meet contact with the facts. And this kind of a discrepancy then between the facts and reality pushes us into a mood of terrible skepticism, into a frustration that knowledge is never going to accomplish anything, that there's no way of being sure of the truth, that all of this is going to be frustrated. You see, if you start off with the assumption that everything is knowable, that nothing is unknowable, and then you discover that there are limits, then the very fabric of knowledge is called into question. Then you begin to think that nothing can be truly knowable. Now, how is the unbeliever going to reconcile these two tendencies, the optimism, the pessimism, the rationalism, the irrationalism, the confidence and the skepticism? How are you going to get these two tendencies working together? Because somehow you have to do justice to both of your moods. You can't be a schizophrenic. You can't be a manic depressive. You have to find some way of life, some way of thinking that does justice to both the kinds of concerns. Well, one way to reconcile these two problematic positions is to say that, well, what we can't know simply can't be known, all right? To say what we can't know simply can't be known. If we can't know it, see, if anything that falls out of this rationalistic program, if we can't know it, well, we can't know it because there's just no truth to be known. There's no truth to be known. Remember, we said that down here that nothing is unknowable. Well, maybe there's a realm of nothing. Maybe there's a realm that can't be spoken of, that can't be known, that is intrinsically irrational, that can't be reached by man's mind. And that's the realm of the irrational. That's the realm in which we try to do justice to our skepticism. And yet that doesn't compromise our rationalism, because it is, after all, the realm of nothing. It is, after all, the realm in which nothing can be said. It is a realm which cannot even be spoken of intelligibly, so it's a realm which we can conveniently ignore most of the time. At least we can try to do it that way. Now, this is the pattern of most philosophy down through the years. Does this work? Does this escape work out? Well, no. I would argue it's a very unstable sort of reconciliation. Because, you see, you can't just forget about this realm. You can't just forget about the realm of the irrational. You can't forget about the nothing. The nothing keeps intruding on you because you are a creature and you know your limits. You are overwhelmed by the greatness of creation. You are overwhelmed by the difficulties of the problems. You are overwhelmed by your own inability to answer these difficult problems that confront you. And so the nothing keeps keeps imposing itself on you. It keeps imposing limits on your thought. It keeps threatening your wisest schemes. It threatens your smartest theories. This poll down here suggests that there are no limits, but this poll here requires that there be limits. And so there's always going to be a conflict. The non-Christian's position is always going to be unstable. You try to avoid talking about this in order to reconcile the two, but you can't. You find yourself having to talk about it. You find yourself having to take account of it. And this then threatens this, and this would seem to rule this out of existence, but regardless of how you do it, the position can't be maintained. This then is what Van Til calls rationalism and irrationalism on the upper corner. Now, in Christianity, we also hold that reason has its powers and reason has its limits. Reason has its powers because God has revealed himself. Reason has its powers because God has made himself clearly known and has made himself accessible to our reason. But reason also has its limits. It has its limits because we're not God. And so we don't understand all the relationships between God's incomprehensible nature and ourselves. Now we don't know, there's a sort of paradox between these two poles. We don't understand all of the relationships between God's incomprehensibility and his revelation to us, and yet there's no real conflict between the upper pole and the lower pole. Because you see, we're not tempted, as the non-Christian is tempted, we're not tempted to claim exhaustive knowledge. When we say down here that reality is accessible to our mind, we don't mean that it's exhaustively accessible. We don't mean that all things are knowable to man. We do assume that all things are knowable to God, and that provides all the basis that we need for saying that knowledge is possible. But we don't claim that knowledge is exhaustively available to us. So we don't make the arrogant claim that the non-Christian makes. We're not forced to justify that impossible kind of claim. On the other hand, we know that our knowledge is limited, but that does not produce skepticism. That does not mean that we lose confidence in our reason altogether. All that means is that our knowledge is limited by a wise and knowing God. And since our knowledge is limited by that kind of God, the limits on our knowledge do not throw us into skepticism. So the powers of our mind don't lead us into arrogance, don't lead us into pride. The limitations on our mind do not lead us into skepticism into despair. So the powers of our mind don't lead us into arrogance, don't lead us into pride. The limitations on our mind do not lead us into skepticism into despair. Now this is the basic structure that I gave you in part two of the course, this square. It's a pedagogical device for teaching some of Van Til's insights on the relationship between Christian philosophy and non-Christian philosophy. And for the next next few lectures, I'm going to be giving examples of this, these relationships from the history of philosophy. Now, we have a real problem here. Some of you have had no philosophical background, and others have had quite a bit. Almost any discussion of philosophers at this point in the course will seem to be incredibly difficult to some of you and terribly superficial to others. Well, I'm going to try to err on the side of superficiality. I'm going to try to be basic. I'm going to try to help the beginners. And I think that will also be of some help to the philosophical scholars in our group. It's always important, I think, at any stage in your philosophical training to try to get back to basics. After all, that is what philosophy is all about. Now, I'm going to talk about ancient philosophy and medieval philosophy in very brief summary. I made course, in your study guide, it suggests that I'm going to get through that today and tomorrow, ancient and medieval philosophy, today and tomorrow. I really kind of doubt that I can present it in quite that condensed form, although the main thrust, so I'm going to be, continuing this into later lectures, and there's going to be a discrepancy between your reading assignments and the lecture material. I don't know really how that can be avoided. But I'm going to try to be relatively brief with the ancient and medieval philosophers because I want to spend most of the time on the modern situation. After all, that's the situation in which we're living now. That's the situation in which we have to present the truth. And I want you to have a better background in that. All right, so let's begin then with a terribly superficial survey of Greek philosophy. Let's see if we can get Plotinus on there. Well, you know that it's about Greek philosophy, so I don't need to put the title on there anymore, I guess. All right, we'll put these guys on there. Now that'll give you some names and some dates. Greek philosophy, to begin with, is like all philosophy, a religious quest. It's an attempt to find a rational substitute for the popular religion, which has been losing its power. Greek philosophy involves the search for a god, the search for a principle which is self-existent, which is self-explanatory, and provides explanations for all things without itself needing an explanation. That's the idea of self-explanatory, or self-justifying, or self-attesting, and also morally self-justifying, providing an absolute basis for right behavior without himself needing a justification, without himself needing a basis. All right, we come first to the so-called Milesian philosophers of the 6th century B.C., that is the 500s. First character there is Thales. Now, we have very little information about these people, really. About all we know about Thales is that he said all is water. We also know that apparently he said that all things are full of gods. And he also predicted an eclipse at one point in history. That's about all we know. And we don't really have any writings of Thales himself. We have quotations of Thales in the works of other philosophers. That's the only way we have any knowledge of Thales, really. Anaximander, we have more material from Anaximander, but the main thrust of his position is that all proceeds from the indefinite, that is the apeiron, that's an alpha there at the beginning, and then the pe, epsilon, iota, rho, omicron, noon. And then Anaximenes, who said that all is air, and he probably said some other things besides that, but we don't know too much of what he said beyond that point. Now, what you see in these, you might ask, well, how can you comment on these guys if you have so little of what they said? You know, if somebody picks up a paper that's a fragment of a paper that you've thrown in the waste paper basket and tries to construct your whole system out of that, they'd probably make a few mistakes, and that's certainly true. The thing is, however, that although we really don't know much about Thales, we do know what kind of influence he has had on the history of philosophy. We do know what Thales has been taken to mean. And what Thales has been taken to mean is more important than what he meant. Doesn't make a whole lot of difference, really, what he meant, his significance in the history of philosophy, his significance in the history of thought is what needs to be evaluated by us. Now, what we find in all three of these thinkers, first of all, is a search for a religious question in the sense that they're asking what is the most basic stuff out of which the world is made. What is the most basic stuff out of which the world is made? Aristotle called this the problem of material causality. Question is simply, what are things made out of? Now, secondly, we notice that there's a significant religious judgment that's made by these three people. Namely, the creator-creature distinction is erased. The creator-creature distinction is erased. All three of these thinkers are making predications about the whole of reality, so that God, if he exists, is himself water too, according to Thales. Both God and man consist of water. Water is the most basic substance out of which the whole universe is made, and all other distinctions are subordinate to that basic substance. Generally, all things are similar in that they are all made out of water. And so you find the creator-creature distinction is erased. A very significant religious assertion then is being made and indicating the apostasy, the non-Christian character, even of Greek philosophy at this very early stage. Thirdly, we have a rationalistic principle suggested in these thinkers. That is, there's the assumption made that the mind is capable of making a judgment about all of reality. Notice the recurrence of the term all in these thinkers. The mind is capable of making an exhaustive judgment. How does Thales know that all is water? Has he examined the whole universe in all its corners to determine what's water and what's not? No, he doesn't have that kind of knowledge, but nevertheless he seems to be claiming it here. He seems to be making that judgment, at least as a theory, that all is water, and advancing that as a rational conclusion, which he feels has far more grounding than any of the popular religious beliefs. Then fourthly, however, there's a temptation toward irrationalism that's brought into philosophy even at this very early stage. That is to say, if all things are reduced to water, or, well, particularly, if all things are reduced to the indefinite, or if all things are reduced to air, then, after all, reason itself is reduced to water. Reason itself is reduced to air. Or reason itself is reduced to something indefinite. Now, there are various ways of getting around. Well, you see what the problem is there. If the mind is water, then all of our philosophizing is just waves of the sea, quite literally. One philosopher criticizing another is just like one wave falling on a beach ahead of another. It's not... There's no reason to say that the one wave is any more valid or any more thoughtful or any more wise than any other wave. It's just all water. It's like Van Til's frequent illustration of the non-Christian as a man who's made out of water, who's living in the water, who's trying to climb out of the water on a ladder of water. It's just impossible to develop any basis for thinking at all. Now, there are various ways of getting around this kind of problem. If you were to ask Thales or to ask Anaximander or Anaximenes how they would avoid this kind of difficulty, they might think of various ways of doing it. First, they might say, well, I'm not simply reducing mind to water. I'm also doing it the other way. I'm also giving water the characteristics of mind. So that I'm not lost in an abyss at all. Rather, I've discovered something very special about water, that water has the properties of thinking, because water, after all, takes all these remarkable forms, and one of the remarkable forms is my brain, which thinks. And so I'm not lost in an ocean of abyss. I've reduced water, in a sense, to mind as much as I've reduced mind to water. But you see what happens here. It's just like this diagram I gave you before. The you move from this kind of rationalism here to an irrationalism where you state that the mind is made out of water, but then you press your rationalism and you say, well, the water really is what my mind takes it to be. The water, in effect, is something more than mere water. The water conforms to my thinking. The water is like my mind. The water, in fact, has the properties of my mind. You discover as you press your rationalism that the water itself is lost. The distinctive properties of the water vanish, and you find something that simply reflects what you yourself have been thinking. The water becomes absorbed into mind. The object of knowledge is lost in the subject. It's absorbed into the subject. Now, there's another way in which you can get around this kind of difficulty. The other way is by saying that the water has many stages. The water goes through many processes. The water, when we say all is water, in itself doesn't adequately express what happens. Actually, there's a whole complicated series of processes by which water changes into something else, by which the water develops into the world in which we live now. But you see, once you say that, you've lost your claim to have given a complete explanation. You've lost your claim to have presented an exhaustive explanation of the way the world is. You see, on this approach, you're denying your initial premise that all is water. It turns out that all is not water. All is water plus a whole series of processes by which the water is changed into the world that we now know. So you have to then continually elaborate your theory. Now, Anaximander, particularly, is one who presented an elaborate process by which the indefinite becomes definite, by which this vast mixture of things in the universe swirls around and various things come out of that indefinite and become the world in which we live. Anaximenes, who held that all is air, also gave an argument showing how everything arises out of condensation and rarefaction. These are the two processes which produce the world in which we live. When air becomes very, very condensed, then it turns into rocks and hard things, trees and chairs and organs and so on. But when it rarefies, then it turns into the various, it turns into fire, it turns into the gases that we know about. Anaximenes and Anaximander are much more elaborate than Thales. They're developing a much more elaborate kind of worldview. And that, of course, is the process that philosophy has to carry on. It has to elaborate these simple statements, and so on and so forth. But the more you admit your need for elaboration, you see, the more you lose this initial confidence that you had at the start of your work. Let's say that all is air plus these processes of condensation and rarefaction. Let's present that as a total worldview. Let's present that as a claim to exhaustive knowledge about the world. Well, there still is another question to be asked, namely, how is it that condensation and rarefaction produce chairs? All right? It seems as though you need a further hypothesis, an additional hypothesis, to show how that happens. Either you say, well, it's just irrational, it just turns into chairs, or else you try to come up with a further explanation of why it turns into chairs. And that need for a further explanation, once you keep admitting that, you're admitting your finitude. As you keep admitting that, you're belying your initial claim to have given an ultimate explanation for the way things are. The fact is, you see, that although Thales and Anaximander and Anaximenes are claiming to set forth the basic stuff of which the universe is made, to set forth the most basic structure of the universe, they failed to do so. And the need for this kind of additional explanation, if you say it's irrational, if you say it just happened that way, then you're conceding that your explanation has not explained. If you say, well, we need some supplementary hypotheses, then again, your initial claim to rationalism has not been fulfilled. So the earliest versions then, the simplest versions of philosophy, have fallen into this rationalist-irrationalist dialectic, which we've seen to be characteristic of all non-Christian thought. Now, I wish I could spend a lot of time sort of giving arguments for arguments and things, but, we could spend the rest of the term talking about the history of philosophy, and I really feel that what I'm saying now is most inadequate, but discuss it in your discussion groups, and I'll be around, and you can argue with me on many occasions. The next group of thinkers would be the Eleatic philosophers. These terms are from names of places where these people had the influence, Milesians and Eleatics. The Eleatics prospered, particularly in the 5th century. The first thinker was Xenophanes, who was mainly a religious teacher, rather skeptical about the popular religions of his day, opposed to the anthropomorphisms in religion, kind of a pantheistic monotheist in his positive views. I mention Xenophanes not because he's particularly important, but mainly to show you that all of these schools of philosophy originated in religious quests and religious discussions. Now, Parmenides and Zeno give arguments for basically for the religious teachings of Xenophanes. Parmenides writes in a religious framework. He writes a poem in which a goddess appears to him, and the goddess, well, she's a strange kind of goddess. She doesn't just set forth revealed truths. She gives Parmenides some arguments. She's a very philosophical kind of goddess, and so Parmenides pits his goddess against the popular gods and goddesses of Greek philosophy or Greek religion. Now, what does the goddess say to Parmenides? The goddess says, first of all, that to say that being is not is contradictory. All right, to say that being is not is contradictory. Do you believe in unicorns? Well, maybe you don't. Would you say that unicorns don't exist? Well, Parmenides thought that was a very strange kind of statement. If you say that a unicorn does not exist, you're saying something very strange and paradoxical and funny. Now, why is that? Well, you see, you start off by talking about something called a unicorn. What is that sentence about? Well, it's a sentence about unicorns, right? And so you start off by using the term unicorn. You start off by wanting to talk about the unicorn, wanting to tell us something about these unicorns, and then you turn right around and say they don't exist. There's something contradictory about that. You start off saying they do exist, and then you turn around saying they don't exist. And how can you possibly do that? Well, the goddess says you just have to avoid using that kind of language. The goddess says that to say anything, say that anything does not exist is to say something self-contradictory. To say that being is not is to say something contradictory. Being is. Of everything that you can think of, it is. Of everything that you can speak of, it is. Thought corresponds with reality. Everything that we think of has some reality. And anything that does not have reality cannot even be thought of, cannot even be spoken of. You see that rationalistic pole there. You see this emphasis. Nothing is unknowable. There's nothing of which you can say that does not exist. What you speak of does exist. What you think of does exist. And so this gives Parmenides great confidence in his thinking because he's persuaded that anything he thinks of, whatever he can consistently think of, must be. Whatever he can consistently think of, that's the way the world is. The world cannot be in any other way. All right, so he develops a whole lot of conclusions from this. What you can think of must be. The world must conform to the structure of the mind. And now the conclusion, now the second point here that the goddess brings is that there is no change. There is no change. We very often talk about acorns changing into trees, but when you think about that, that's a very odd kind of concept. After all, it suggests that a tree can come into being from something that's not a tree. That one thing, namely an acorn, can change into something else, namely a tree. How can a tree come into being from a non-tree? There are no non-trees, says the goddess. That's negation. There is no such thing as a tree which does not exist at a particular time. Everything that you can think of does exist. And so there is no non-tree. It's meaningless to speak about a change from a non-tree to a tree. It's meaningless to speak of a change from an acorn to a non-acorn. In fact, she says the whole concept of change is meaningless, and we have to reject it, because the concept of change involves the concept of non-being, and logical thought will not tolerate the idea of non-being. It will not tolerate the idea of nothing. You see, he's trying rigorously to get away from that irrationalistic pole. And say that irrationalistic side of creation, just you can't even speak about it. You can't even talk about it. You just have to banish it from your thoughts altogether. And so the answer then is that reality must be changeless. Parmenides then goes into a lot of other arguments. Reality is ungenerated. Reality is indestructible. Reality is changeless. It's homogeneous. It's continuous, that is, there are no parts, it is perfect, it is motionless, and so on and so forth. Now, a lot of, along the line, he offers a lot of bad arguments, but basically this is a relentless attempt to develop a view of being where there is an utter and total complete correspondence between the mind and the reality. The mind cannot conceive of change, so there is no change. The mind can't conceive of motion, so there is no motion. Thales said, all is water. Well, that was inadequate. There must be water plus something else. Parmenides argues there is no such thing as water plus something else. All you can say about the world is that it is, pure and simple. There is no discrepancy between explanation and reality. The explanation is perfectly adequate. It needs no supplementation. All is identical with this philosophical concept of being that Parmenides has developed out of his own power of rational thought. You see, there's a problem here. The world that Parmenides pictures is not the real world. There is change. There is motion. There is diversity. Somehow he's got to reckon with that. And that's going to put Parmenides into a terrible bind. We'll talk about that tomorrow.